everybody. Welcome to the live retail online integration webinar titled How to Protect and Increase Your Bottom Line with Fraud Protection, sponsored by Count. My name is Melissa Campanelli, and I'm Editor-in-Chief of ROI and the host of today's event. As cybercrime evolves, the size, speed, and sophistication of fraud and fraud networks makes uncovering fraudsters more difficult than ever for retailers today. New methods of purchasing, such as mobile devices, alternative payments, add to the complexity. What's more, businesses that sell products online are 100% responsible for losses and costs associated with fraud, like chargebacks. Today you'll hear from two fraud protection experts, David Montague, founder and president of the Fraud Practice, and Don E. Bush, director of marketing for Count, who will help you gain a greater understanding of the global fraud landscape, the latest trends and steps companies can take now to protect their bottom line. Today, you'll learn the real costs of fraud detection, how overseas markets can increase e-commerce growth, how to catch fraudsters on a variety of devices, and so much more. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips about how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget. You should see that at the bottom of your console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. You can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer as well so that you can use all of the widgets and bells and whistles on this console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. With that, let me introduce our first speaker, David Montague. Take it away, David.
Hello, welcome, and thank you for taking the time to attend. As Melissa shared, I am the president of a very specialized consultancy called the Fraud Practice that specializes in assessing and building strategies for electronic payments and fraud prevention. I've been working in this field for over 17 years and have written a couple books based on e-commerce fraud and security management for the online and call center channels, and I've had the pleasure of working with clients across the entire ecosystem to include merchants, processors, acquirers, vendors, card associations as well, and they've included companies that are startups all the way to Fortune 50, and they come from all regions of the world. Today, I'm going to share some insights in relation to what we see when it comes to common challenges that merchants face when they're dealing with fraud management and how it basically affects the way that they do business and actually how they actually convert that into real profit. So to get us started, let's talk a little bit about the impact of fraud on a business. You know, the reality is when we talk about the e-commerce channels, whether it's online or through the telephone, through the call center, there are very few payment options that you have available that are actually going to offer a guarantee that you're going to get your money if it actually is a fraudulent transaction. So it's really on you as the merchant to basically do something to prevent fraud. Now, we all understand that when we get hit by fraud as a merchant, we actually lose money because we've lost our product, as well as other costs that might be associated with it. But you do need to understand that when fraud impacts a merchant, it actually does damage to other areas of the business as well. So the natural reaction within a business is as they basically experience fraud, they start to implement changes to the way that they interact with their customers, as well as to how they review that information. And that can actually lead to a degradation in the customer experience, as well as an elongated fulfillment time as you basically take more time to review those transactions. And obviously, as an organization, the more unprepared you are to manage fraud within your organization, the more substantial that impact could be on your customer experience. Likewise, when a business is being impacted by fraud, there is the potential for brand damage. Now, this goes, you know, in two different kind of channels. We basically have brand damage in the effect that, you know, if we're associated with something like a broader fraud problem, it becomes public. But there's also brand damage from the standpoint that when somebody uses a stolen credit card on our site, that person's card that they stole obviously is not going to have a favorable image of your organization, of your brand. Even though you had nothing to do with it, their natural reaction is to basically say, you know, how did you not know it wasn't me trying to place that transaction? So it's kind of a no-win situation. And the last thing to consider about fraud in your business is that there's a lost opportunity to basically convert sales. Fraudsters don't focus on stealing the goods that you have in your warehouse that nobody wants. They focus on the goods in your warehouse that everybody does want because they know that those are the products that they can move. So if the fraudsters are basically taking that inventory and stealing it from you, there's the potential that you're not going to have inventory available for your legitimate customers. Thus, you actually will have an opportunity loss in terms of sales conversion. Now, when it comes to fraud, fraud can actually affect and change the way you actually do business. So from what you actually ask for from your customers to actually how you fulfill your transactions. So if you think about it, even the data fields that you have on your website can be impacted from fraud. So you may actually decide that you're going to collect additional pieces of information, not because you need them to actually complete the sale, but you actually need them in order to basically create an effective fraud management process. Likewise, it can actually change how you allow your customers to change their information on your site, whether it's their billing address, their shipping address, their email, based on your overall exposure to fraud, i.e., account takeovers and the like, you may decide that, you're going to be more strict in the way that you basically process those changes. And it can also affect your policy in relation to returns and credits, as well as, how you actually process transactions. The thing that you need to keep in mind is when you look at your business, 99% of the transactions that are flowing through your system, as an example, are really good customers. And, that bad population is a very small percentage of the transactions that are actually coming through. And what we don't want to do is basically implement a fraud management program that basically diminishes the experience for the 99% just to basically take care of that 1% that are causing the problem. So you need to make sure that there really is a good balance. Otherwise, it can basically change the way your customer base is going to perceive your particular organization. Now, from a management approach, most organizations, when we talk about traditional retail, basically say, hey, when it comes to fraud, all I'm interested in is basically keeping myself out of trouble. If it isn't broke, I'm not going to basically mess with it. It's not a core asset of the company. It's not something they want to focus on. And that, for most organizations, that is correct. Fraud is not why they basically set up their business. They basically manage and basically look at fraud from the context of basically it's a part of doing business, but it's not the reason that I do business. And that being said, from a management perspective, you need to be careful. Pushing too hard from the upper-level management down on preventing fraud, being risk-averse, can negatively affect your sales conversion as your fraud resources within the organization are going to become adverse. They're going to pick up on the fact that you do not want that fraud, and you're much more likely to insult a valid customer. Likewise, if you basically take the opposite approach and you show no real concern at all about fraud management, you don't talk about it, you don't discuss it at any point, that atmosphere of complacency can come into play, and that's just as dangerous because then you're going to make it less likely that, personnel within your organization are going to come to you and say, hey, look, I see that we may have a problem with the way that we have this set up where fraudsters could exploit this. And they're basically saying, well, we haven't had a problem yet, so maybe it's not a problem. We're just not going to do anything about it until we actually have a significant emotional event. Now, when we look at, the world today, in terms of what's happening, obviously there are a number of different channels that customers can come to us. And, some organizations on the call today may be pure e-commerce plays, and some actually might be, multi-channel. And obviously from a market perspective, there is a drive towards what we call omni-channel, where we're trying to basically allow our customers to get access to us in multiple different channels when they're basically prepared and ready to buy. And so from a business perspective, you know, we can basically see that, you know, these channels are starting to morph and to blend, and they're starting to cross over. So we're actually starting to see that from a customer perspective, you know, customers might shop online, buy in the store. They may, you know, shop online and buy on their mobile. They might, you know, shop on the mobile and call in and place an order. But, you know, most organizations from a fraud perspective look at these particular channels typically as a silo, independently. And from a risk perspective, they haven't really crossed them over to ensure that they understand, you know, I have a customer and that customer could access, you know, my particular business from multiple different points within the ecosystem. Likewise, we're actually starting to see that more activities occurring on these higher risk channels, these channels that are more difficult to determine risk and to manage risk in terms of the financial dollars at the end of the day. Now, on top of the channels, we need to consider the different payment methods that we accept. It's not just about credit cards in today's environment. You know, most organizations have multiple forms of payment that they allow their customers to use. And we're finding that, you know, again, these payment methods are crossing over into multiple different channels, but as an organization, most organizations still look at them independently within those channels. So they're not actually identifying and making use of the fact that we know that a particular credit card or payment form has been used in multiple different channels so that we actually know a particular customer when they come to our site. Likewise, we're starting to see, you know, more and more use of alternative payment forms. So things like, you know, the PayPals and the direct debit and ACH and, you know, now you have the emergence of true mobile payments coming into play. It's becoming much more of a mainstream type of a component when it comes to processing our transactions through that online channel. When it comes to fraud, you know, most organizations understand and really focus their attention on what we call third-party fraud. Now, third-party fraud means that somebody actually took somebody else's credit card and then committed fraud using that credit card. Or first-party fraud, which we typically call friendly fraud, is where it's actually the legitimate cardholder that used the card on our site, but they're saying that I never got it, I didn't place the order, it's not me, but we know it really is them. And most organizations focus all of their attention really on that third-party fraud. And you need to understand that, you know, hey, there's a lot of different ways that fraudsters can basically attack your site, and these rings are going to attack from multiple different component areas, and you need to make sure that you're actually dealing with a strategy that effectively is looking at fraud risk from all the different ways that a fraudster can come into their site. You also need to consider the fact that losses today and events are becoming much more public. So when you actually do have a negative event, it's most likely going to get out into the public domain if it's of any size. And you need to kind of keep that in mind in terms of, you know, why should we basically do anything to prevent fraud if we don't have a fraud problem today? Well, you know, at the least, you know, we do not want to be basically that lead story on ABC or Frontline basically talking about fraud happening in the marketplace. And just to give an example of, you know, the meaningfulness of the type of fraud that occurs, you'll see in here, you know, basically, you know, things like affiliate fraud. You know, there was an article that came out a couple weeks ago now around Nordstrom and around a couple of fraud guys that basically were able to steal over $1 million, basically committing what we call commission fraud, to basically bring in business that basically didn't turn into real business. So, you know, fraudsters are very creative. They will find a way to steal from you, and you want to make sure that you're paying attention to all the different ways that money comes into the system, and just importantly, you know, how money goes back out of the system. Now, the next thing you need to basically keep in mind is, you know, when it comes to fraud, you know, fraud is not going away. You know, all the early lead indicators that we look at, you know, such as malware and breaches, you know, they're rising exponentially, and they're rising month over month. You know, so it's a crazy escalation pattern that we see. And obviously that means that there's going to be more and more inventory when it comes to stolen billing instruments on the black market for folks to actually go out and commit fraud. All right. So what can you do about it? Number one thing is, you know, you don't want to be the weakest link in the marketplace. Fraudsters, you know if you're doing anything to prevent fraud, and they're focused on finding the merchants that aren't doing anything and then committing their fraud there. So, you know, the idea is you don't need to be the absolute experts in the highest level, you know, producers in terms of fraud prevention. You just want to be better than the next guy in terms of your competition to basically ensure that, you know, that just get them to move somewhere else. You need to also consider that, you know, fraud rings are very patient. You know, they work a site over months to years. So in most cases when we go in and we, you know, we finally get that call that, hey, we're in a significant emotional event, we're losing a lot of money, we go back in and we can actually show them that, you know, hey, these guys have actually been here for over a year. You just didn't know that they were here, and this is what they've been doing to test your system and probe you before they really started to commit their large-scale harvest activities. You know, fraudsters are, you know, from a professional fraud ring perspective, you know, they're going to hit you across all of your channels. They're going to hit you with multiple different events, and they're going to basically use multiple different payment methods under multiple types of attacks. You know, it is not kind of a one-size, you know, fits all, you know, attack. They do migrate it. They have it planned out. They already know what the next attack is going to be. If you do not stop them, they will try it again, that same attack, until you can stop it. But they already have a progression in mind in terms of how they're going to move it, because they know that most merchants will react by simply trying to put a Band-Aid on how they actually got hit last time. So when we try to balance our needs, you know, the other thing that we want to make sure that we keep in mind is, you know, Don't go and mandate a zero fraud policy. You know, that's not what we recommend. You know, in 17 years of doing this, you know, I only have one client that actually has a zero fraud policy, and that was even that was very, very different in terms of you know, what we would typically see. You know, the fact is, it really isn't practical to stop all fraud, and it can be quite expensive and time consuming, and it really does impact the customer experience. You typically are going to experience some friendly fraud regardless of what you do. And if somebody really wants to steal from you, you know, they will. They will find a way to go do it. And, you know, it really does impact that customer experience as you basically try to push that bar too far into that zero zone. And then, you know, when you really, at the end of the day, when you do the math, you know, taking some fraud, it typically leads to a more profitable overall business, you know, as long as you have some meaningful volume going on as a business today. The last thing I'll talk about before I turn it over is, you know, I get asked a lot, you know, hey, you know, the credit card associations give us these tools, you know, isn't that really enough to kind of take care of fraud? And the reality is it's not. It's just not enough to really protect your business from fraud occurring. You have to understand that, you know, the credit card system and the tools that they offer are still designed around, you know, producing and managing an immediate payment and a good cash flow. And it's kind of a least common denominator. And these fraud tools are typically poor predictors of fraud, meaning that when we do the analysis, it's much more likely that a fraudster will come out with a perfect ABS and a perfect card security code than it is for a good consumer. You know, so you're really, by implementing policies too strong using those types of signals is actually more likely to cause insults than it is to actually catch real fraudsters. And they really do not provide you with any additional fraud protection per se, except for in the collection side in terms of, you know, trying to recoup those chargebacks. And, you know, from a loss perspective, you know, you're not paying much for them, but you still have that direct loss that you're going to, as well as penalties that you're going to pay to the credit card association. So, you know, the one thing that I would give you as a takeaway is, you know, you will have to do more than what the credit card associations are giving you to ensure that your company is protected from a potential fraud attack. All right. So I'll go ahead and turn it back over to Melissa. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you so much, David. That was some great information, some great real technical stuff at the end, which was great for our listeners. So I now would like to send the microphone over to Don E. Bush, the marketing VP at Count, and take it away, Don.
Thanks, Melissa. I'll move that picture so you don't have to be subjected to that for very long, but I appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk a little bit about fraud and how to maximize your revenue opportunities by minimizing your fraud and putting those tools and strategies in place. I get the opportunity to meet with merchants and speak with analysts and experts in the industry on a weekly basis, and so some of the things that we'll talk about in the next few minutes will show trends, and got a couple of case studies in here, but I want to get through this rather quickly and leave time for questions. However, if you've got questions that you'd like to ask and it's during the presentation, feel free to do that. We'll try and field those as they come up if they're relevant to that part of the presentation. Thanks, David. I appreciate what David said. He talked about a lot of different things, sort of setting the stage, and we will boil down a little bit more into closer to home with merchants and what they deal with. But this graph on the slide here is really what we're all about. We want to maximize those sales and minimize fraud and do it in a way that is revenue generating, revenue positive to organizations. You know, there's an interesting trend going on right now. You see the red line there, that's payments and the cost for payment processing and all those different things. That's actually dropping now in the industry. We see the other line, green line there for e-com. It's actually increasing. Last year, e-commerce increased by about 16% according to experts. However, look at that last line there, fraud. It continues to increase. I've got a stat in this slide. You'll see a little bit later. It says 22%. Gartner came out this week and said fraud in 2011 actually grew by 25%. So when you've got e-commerce expanding by 16 and fraud expanding by 25, you know that there's a real force to be reckoned with out there, and we need to pay more attention to it. This is an issue that a lot of merchants, a lot of companies out there, I don't have a fraud problem. And my response to that is that there's two types of companies, those that have been hit by fraud and those who will be hit by fraud. To turn a blind eye to this is not a strategy. Everybody has to deal with fraud, as David said, either to protect yourselves from being a headline or to protect your bottom line. And those are things that we want to make sure that everybody recognizes and prepares for. Real briefly, some of the things that we'll talk about. Fraud was $100 billion in losses last year for businesses. Visa said it's the number one reason for chargebacks. It's a growing problem. It's something that we need to deal with. It happens very quickly. The cost of fraud to merchants, David mentioned a few of these things. I just want to hit a couple of things here. 50% of chargebacks are direct result of fraud. The average rejection rate in the United States is about 2.4%. What that means is orders are rejected because of fear of fraud. Internationally, it more than doubles. It triples to just under 8% of orders are rejected because of suspicion of fraud. There was a customer satisfaction survey done a couple of months ago by American Express. David said this can impact your customer experience. American Express came out and said, here's how it impacts it. By having orders delayed, in other words, if I've got to manually review an order, or if I take longer than a few seconds to approve an order, 38% of the times customers have a negative feeling towards that brand, and 28% of the time they will either cancel their order or go to another brand to make that sale, to make that purchase. That's the significance of a brand experience, a customer experience, because of fraud systems that aren't doing their job quickly enough in our internet world. That's a tough statistic to deal with, but it's real. It's out there in the market today. Other things that you have to deal with is manual reviews are difficult. It's hard to scale when your business grows. Increasing e-commerce activity, like David mentioned earlier, mobile, online, digital downloads, all these different ways of doing commerce online make it a little bit more easy for fraudsters. And the last bullet here is really the one I want to hit on is most merchants are not fraud experts. You didn't get in the business because you're a fraud expert. You got in the business to expand a brick and mortar. You got in the business because you love what you do, or you run a business that sells products and services that are necessary in the marketplace, not because we're fraud experts. Some of the types of fraud that we see, David mentioned some of these, but when you look at it, years ago it used to be a hacker would come in and steal from you. We've seen the sophistication grow into groups, criminal elements all over the world. This was a very interesting article that came out last year in Wired magazine. There's a little town in Romania. The number one industry for this town was cybercrime. They were setting up ways to steal from companies all over the world, and it was the number one industry by revenue in this town. When you start looking at fraud rings around the world, they are broad, they are wide, they are well-organized, and they're ready to steal from you. They want to turn whatever they can into cash as quickly as possible, and we need to be prepared for them. These are some of the types of fraud that we will see. Botnets, malware, criminal networks, account takeover. What about virtual currency? What's happening in social? Paper downloads and so on. All these things are things we need to be aware of and be prepared for. One of the things that many companies fail to do is anytime there is a transfer of information, it doesn't have to be a payment, but it could be an application online. It could be other information online, like logging into an account. Anytime there's a transfer of information is a potential threat and a potential opportunity for a fraudster. And all of these types of fraud take advantage of those things whenever there's a handoff of information. So keep that in mind. We said this earlier, merchants aren't fraud experts. Here's some of the questions that get asked. You know, where should my chargeback rate be? That seems to be the bellwether out in the industry is a chargeback rate, and it set the standard. And while that's a good measurement, it's not the only measurement. We'll talk about other measurements we need to take in our system to properly detect whether we have a fraud issue. What about international? Seems risky. What about affiliate programs? Whether I run my own or I go to a third-party affiliate group to help run an affiliate program, how do I minimize fraud in those areas? Does my fraud program now negatively affect sales? We'll show how this has happened in a number of companies already. But these are some of the questions that merchants will ask and should ask themselves. And here's some more. Recognizing the symptoms of fraud, these are just some highlights of things that you may want to ask yourself. And if you answer in the affirmative of some of these, you may have a fraud problem. You may have something that you need to deal with that is under the radar, but something that needs to be dealt with. You know, where is my chargeback rate? What is my return rate? Do I return a lot of stuff because I'm suspicious that the transaction that just took place is fraud? What about my order rejection rate? You know, is it over 1%? They say the national average is 2.4 for the U.S., 7.7 internationally. We think those are 3 and 5 and 10 times higher than they need to be. But if you're over 1%, that should be looked at. What about high affiliate turnover? We just saw in the last couple of months a huge affiliate breaching group out of the Philippines by the hundreds and thousands going into affiliate networks, setting up an affiliate account, grabbing products, selling them, getting their commission checks, and leaving before anything can be done about it. High turnover. What about manual reviews? If you're above 10%, that may be one of those things that says you've got a fraud problem or at least a fraud system problem. So these are some of the things that we may want to look at to recognize the symptoms of fraud. Beyond chargeback rates, we're going to talk about more than chargeback rates. What are our strategies to reduce fraud, securely expanding into new channels and markets, and then turning fraud management into a revenue generator, how that can actually happen in our system. Let's first talk about a proper fraud strategy. We believe a proper fraud strategy has three legs, and the first one is detection. How can I detect what's going on in my system? And that happens a number of different ways. Strategy management. Once I've detected information, whether it's a good transaction or a bad transaction, what do I do with that information? In my strategy management, this tells me how I react to the information that I get. And then the last step of that is, what's my operation strategy? Once I get that information, once I've reacted to that information properly, where does that information go? Does it go into my operations, my logistics, my finance, accounting software, any other things that information may be useful inside my operation? We'll talk briefly about each one of these legs of the stool, so to speak. When we look into fraud protection or fraud detection, a graph like this is pretty simple. What we're looking for is good orders that look good, bad orders that look bad. Those typically seem to be the easiest pieces to catch. And here's how that works. Once a transaction takes place, we send that information to a real-time analytics process. And that takes a number of different tools or features in a system. That could be anything from geolocation to velocity checks to affiliates to device fingerprinting to proxy piercing. All these different types of tools that help us detect and determine if fraud is prevalent or present during this particular transaction. Now, something to be said about the number of tools that get used. This is a survey that was done with the MRC last year. The MRC is the Merchant Risk Council. They're a nonprofit organization set up for merchants to help do safe and risk-free payments and fraud detection. And they looked at all their users and said, tell us how many fraud detection tools you use. And the trend was, add more tools. Throw more tools into the toolbox so I can detect more fraud. And we think that has some merit, but we also think there are some real issues with just adding more tools to the mix. Some of the tools that were indicated were things like order linking, custom rules engines, affiliate management, dynamic scoring, and then proxy detection and fingerprinting. Those types of tools were all those things that merchants were looking to add to find more fraud in their system. Dave mentioned this earlier, but I want to iterate it again here. There are a number of tools out there. Tools should be more dynamic than ever before today. Things like CVV and ABS are no longer effective. I can go online right now. I can buy credit card data. I can buy secure data. I can buy CVV and ABS data that matches that. I was on a panel last week with several experts. One of them said, we went in and looked at the fraud of XYZ company and determined that even though it was a fraudulent transaction, they were getting ABS matches of 95% and CVV matches of 100%. That's the type of data that we call static. That static data, or that data that resides in a database, is not real time or dynamic, is easily gotten around by fraudsters. The more dynamic the data, the better the performance criteria. Remember, speed and flexibility online is critical. In our world of iTunes, where I get downloads immediately, customers are more and more impatient. So the more we delay them with that fraud screening in our process, as the Amex report came back and said, we risk customer having a bad experience, we risk brand damage, and we also risk losing sales to dissatisfaction. Those performance comprehensive fraud checks need to be done in an interlocking across all the range of customer interactions, anywhere that transfer of information takes place. Now, the difficult part in this is good orders that look bad and bad orders that look good. And this is what I mean when we say fraud detection. Excuse me. When we detect fraud or we detect the suspicion of fraud, what do we do with that information? And that is the next step when we start talking about our business strategy. Our business strategy takes that information and gives us a predictive or analysis of what they think that order is, whether it's good, bad, or needs more information. So we'll take that information and we put it into, I'm calling it a rules engine for now. And all that information now has business strategy placed on it. You know, if somebody's ordering from Ireland, that's not automatically fraudulent, but how do we deal with that in a business sense? Is that an area that we do business? Do we want to ship overseas? Do we have support overseas? If somebody has three email addresses associated with one credit card, that's not automatically fraud, but we might want to take a further look at it. But this is where that business strategy of our tolerance for risk and how we react to that information comes in place. And then the last step here is, now what do we do with that information now that we've accepted it? We accept an order, decline an order, or we send it off maybe to a manual review process. Once that all is completed, we send that over to our operations, our finance, our logistics, and all the other systems within our organization that need that information for records and other processing of the order. Another fraud trend is when people expand into new markets, the hesitancy to go, you know, how do I maximize my online presence? Well, international. By virtue of you being online, you become a global company. People all over the world can look and attempt to order or attempt to transact with you. What about high-risk countries, and what's my upside there? Well, the Wall Street Journal last year came out and said 70% of CFOs surveyed found that they were going to have to go to international markets to find the growth and the incremental revenue that they were expecting. And this is something that is difficult for a lot of companies. They look and wonder, how can I go international when fraud is so high? You saw the statistics, three times higher than in North America. How do I do that? Let's add a little bit more to this. I thought it'd be interesting here to throw in some information on mobile payments. You know, in the last couple of years, we've seen mobile payments grow at an astronomical rate. How does that affect our overall fraud? And here's some statistics that we brought in. With the four top mobile devices, the transaction approval rate that we see is what you see on the screen here. Now, why would an iPad have less approval rating than an Android or an iPhone? Are they less trustworthy customers? Is there more fraud there? Well, without the proper information with our system, we wouldn't be able to determine that. Here's what's happening. An iPad has an order that's over double on average of an Android phone or a BlackBerry phone. So most merchants are looking at that a little bit harder, and they don't automatically approve it. However, when we look at the fraud rate of an iPad, it's 15 basis points. And when we look at the fraud rate of an Android, it's actually higher. Without this information, we have a difficult time expanding into new markets, accepting orders from any device that's out there. And so these are the types of critical reports, business intelligence, that we need to have within our system to give us the feedback to make good, sound business strategy decisions. You know, we see a lot of fraud problems. I'm out, like I said, often, weekly, around the world, and we talk to folks about what are their fraud problems, what do they see. Affiliate-generated sales are difficult. Because if it's not an internal system, I'm using a third-party affiliate group, I'm an arm's length away from that sale or that lead. If my affiliate group is not doing a good job at fraud monitoring, they're just passing me the fraud, and that's a difficult thing to manage. David mentioned friendly fraud. How do we manage that? Fines for Visa and MasterCard and chargeback monitoring programs are exorbitant if you go over their chargeback rates and their risk analysis.
You know, I'm just going to jump here for a quick second. Sorry, Don. Last time we did a webinar with you guys, there was a lot of questions about what friendly fraud is. So why don't you just briefly tell the listeners, just in case they don't know.
Absolutely. Thanks. I appreciate that. Let's cover that.
Yeah.
Friendly fraud is when fraud is not done with stolen credentials or through a quote-unquote criminal element. So, for instance, I have an Xbox system set up at my house. It's got my credit card information on it. But my son comes in, and he orders the latest War of the Worlds game, and it costs $50. And he didn't steal my information. It's my account, but he ordered something that I didn't know about. I'm going to get my bill, And I'm going to go, I didn't order this new game. And I'm going to call up my bank and say, take that off my bill. And they're going to say, okay, that's what we call friendly fraud. Or somebody orders something from, let's say, Nordstrom's, as we heard earlier, and they say, well, never received it, didn't get it, never showed up. And they've actually stolen something. It was a valid account, a valid order, and yet the customer is denying that they received merchandise. So those are the types of things we call friendly fraud. They're not very friendly, but it's not, quote, unquote, a criminal element or a fraudster with stolen credentials. So does that help, Melissa?
Yes, absolutely. I just remember that was, just sort of has a name that folks sometimes don't really know what that means. So just thought I'd, just in case, folks didn't ask the question, I just thought I'd clarify for some people.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. I want to make sure we're clear here. Some of the other fraud problems, the last one I'll show here is reserves. If you're in an industry, you have higher chargeback rates or fraud rates, you may be required by your merchant bank to have a higher reserve than normal, and that's a problem. Here's some of the typical remedies that we see merchants or companies do. They simply turn off their affiliate marketing program. We look at that as cutting out a complete channel of sales opportunity because of the fear of fraud. Or they'll turn off IP addresses on a local or countrywide basis. I just won't do business with folks in Nigeria because Nigeria's got a lot of fraud. Well, we look at that as a mistake. Turning off countries because of fear of fraud is not something we think we should do. You can turn off countries for legitimate reasons. It's an OFAC country and it's illegal to do business there. That's a good one. You don't want to go to jail. I can't logistically support my product in that country. I sell inner tubes and they don't have tires, whatever. Or I don't have a customer support in that country that supports my product and it needs that, so I just don't do business there. I don't want to ship to there because it's exorbitant shipping costs or tariffs. Those are legitimate business reasons for not doing business in a country. Even Nigeria, if fraud is 50%, means 50% of the orders are good. And if I've got a proper screening management system and proper strategy for my business, I should be able to even take orders from those countries. So we look at that and say that can be a difficult thing. I use CVV and AVS. Well, as we've already heard, those can be gotten around very, very easily. And even David mentioned this earlier, we see this far too often. I've never had fraud, so I'll just sit down and wait. I'll cross my fingers. I'll hope it doesn't come to me. That's just not a strategy. That's not good for the immediate or the long term. But those are typical things we see many merchants do. What I'd like to do is just spend the next couple of minutes talking about a couple of case studies here and how they thwarted fraud and still showed positive revenue growth. Hmm. Bodybuilding.com is a company that very large business. They do transactions all over the world. They're the number one online sports nutrition retailer, and they have a great brand presence. They were using an internal fraud system, which a lot of companies do, and yet over a period of 6 to 8 to 12 months, they saw fraud creep up slowly but surely and tried to turn it off, tried to cut it back. They added manual review up to about 30% manual review. They had a high decline rate where they were just declining orders that seemed to be fraudulent. They saw their chargeback rate climb above 1%, and Visa and MasterCard were happy to accept them into that excessive chargeback club and charge them thousands and thousands of dollars while that rate was above 1%. They implemented a fraud platform. I'll tell you, it was Count, so open doors there. They spent 30 days optimizing with their rules and their system, and here was the outcome. Their chargeback reduction of 85%, they saw savings immediately of $90,000 a month. They reduced their rejection, their declined orders by 14%. Their declined order rate was below 1.5%, half of the national average. Their surprise, they saw a 5% increase in overall transactions. Overseas and domestically, a 5% overall transactions increase. getting back to the how do the customers feel about this, no customer order interruptions. There was an average response time of 304 milliseconds, so it didn't disrupt that purchasing process. They were able to increase their operational efficiencies because their manual reviews dropped from 30% down to less than 10, and now they're expanding into new markets and new sales, and that's exactly what you want to see happen. Another company called CD Baby, the world's largest distributor of independent music artists. They help artists sell on iTunes and Amazon and Facebook. They pay out a high commission to their affiliates. They paid out a couple hundred million dollars in their affiliates. And what was happening is they were paying their affiliates and yet getting high chargebacks and other fraud issues, and they didn't know what was happening. They were losing as much as $26,000 a month. The worst thing is they had a brand reputation with iTunes because a lot of complaints came into iTunes about being charged for something that customers said they didn't get, and that was an issue. They didn't want to ruin that relationship. What CD Baby found after they implemented a proper fraud solution was they reduced their fraud by 96% and saw fraud losses drop to about $850 a month with no revenue loss. Great relationship with iTunes. Let me tell you, Dave said that fraudsters can be creative. Let me tell you how creative these fraudsters were. They were actually stealing music online, going to CD Baby and posting it as their own, so they became the recording artist. Then they would go to CD Baby and join the affiliate program. Then they would use stolen credentials to buy music through the affiliate program. So they were being paid as an artist. Then they were being paid as an affiliate. And before anybody knew anything, they would close their account and leave. Well, without a proper fraud detection system, they weren't able to put those links together. And as soon as they had their system put up and running, again, they used Count. They were able to link those things together, and they turned that fraud problem off in a matter of 30 days. The relationship with iTunes is fantastic, and they continue to grow and expand into new areas and new countries. In summary, several data points help you determine fraud. Managing fraud requires a full strategy, not just a bunch more tools. You do need to have those tools in place, but you need to have that business strategy in place as well. What do you do with that information once you get it? Fraud management should not be inhibiting your ability to sell in new markets, in new countries, in new places, new products, and so forth. We have a customer that was scared to death of doing digital products, and because they had a fraud system that was in place, they started selling digital products, enhancing revenues, and providing their customers with even more products to purchase. Fraud management does not need to be a cost center. In fact, it should be a revenue enhancer. Where's fraud going to be tomorrow? What's it going to look like in a couple of years? I don't have any idea. Those guys are very creative. Who would have expected mobile to have the effect even a couple of years ago? What's going to happen in the next 2 years? We don't know. Your fraud system needs to be something that's dynamic, that gets reviewed on a regular basis, because fraudsters change how they steal from you. And that needs to be something that is looked at on a regular basis. I just want to say thanks for spending some time with us. We've got about 10 or 15 minutes now. We could be happy to answer questions. There's some contact information on the page here if you want to get a hold of David or myself. I'd be happy to answer questions online or give you any other information that that you might need. And I'm going to hand it back over to Melissa. Please feel free to ask questions, and we will answer those the best we can.
Great. Thanks so much. Don, great presentation. Yes, we definitely would love questions, but I have a few, so how about we just get started with that. Don, I guess my one question I wanted to ask about was the impact of social around fraud. I know we talked about mobile, but, you know, is there any connection between more and more people, you know, either perhaps buying on on Facebook commerce, or linking from a social media page to an e-commerce site to purchase something? Is that creating any fraud issues that maybe haven't been reported on or anything like that?
I wouldn't say it's created anything that hasn't been reported on, but here's what happens with social networks. They're a little bit cutting edge. Gaming companies, they're a little bit cutting edge. They help change the model a little bit. We're using virtual currency more often. We're seeing established accounts so that I can use an account that I've established to draw down or to buy with. And so fraudsters are going in and taking those accounts over. We might go into a game and put $50 on an account so that I can buy weapons or goods or things like that.
Virtual
and they'll walk in, and they will take over that account, and now they spend all that money or they use it and sell it online, and now I've lost that. You know, with bodybuilding, the fraudsters were going in using false credentials, buying all kinds of nutrition. They opened an eBay store and were selling it for half price online. They want to turn stuff to cash as quickly as possible. When you've got new and leading-edge technologies or areas of the market like social, like gaming, fraudsters are always going to go there. There's weak spots. They're going to exploit whatever they see. Fraudsters, you can go online and find folks that specialize in getting information from social networks. They're going to get your name, where you live, the city, your email address, all these different things that they can use against a consumer. And it makes it even more and more difficult for us to detect who those people are and where they're coming from. So it opens a lot more doors.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing the things. Are we reacting fast enough as an industry? Probably not. Are there things we can do to help offset those? Absolutely. Absolutely ways we can detect those things and help merchants save their money.
Something I would add to that is, you know, when we talk about the social networking sites today, you know, like the Facebooks and the Twitters and other similar applications. When we talk about SSO technology, single sign-on, I'm actually using that for authentication and credentialing. You know, that's a big question where people are like, hey, can I, you know, let's do that, right, and make it faster for people to kind of get into our system to convert a sale. It can be done effectively, but from a credentialing perspective, you have to understand that you know, it's only as strong as the weakest link. And, you know, from a fraudster's perspective, you know, if they can basically steal somebody's Facebook account, then use SSO to get into your site, it kind of gives, you know, that merchant a false level of security that this really is that person. And that's where you can go horribly wrong with that technology. You know, the fact is, you know, you have to look at your password policy versus a Facebook policy or whoever that other, you know, organization is that you're going to integrate with their SSO and make sure that you understand, you know, how much trust to really put into that credential as they basically cross over into your particular site. So, you know, from a fraud perspective, it's something that you know, I get asked about to, you know, how do we actually do this smartly?
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely something that you've got to pay attention to. You can't just assume that, you know, Johnny coming over from Facebook is really Johnny.
Yeah, definitely. I spoke to not really a fraud expert, but a privacy expert recently, and he talked about the importance of, you know, making sure that you understand the social networking privacy policies, you know, before you do any kind of marketing with them, because, you know, everybody has their own policies around them. So that sort of ties in also, I would think. Let's see, we actually have a question, which is great. And I guess this is for either one of you, so let me ask it. Compared to fraud, where an actual sale occurs, can you speak about what is known about card testing? Via simply attempting, yeah, that's interesting, via attempting to authenticate a card to validate it.
Yeah, let me just explain or put a definition around what card testing is. Fraudsters will go out and they'll either steal or they'll go online to certain marketplaces and they'll buy a group of credit cards. They might buy a block of 100 or 1,000. It doesn't matter. They can either buy them validated and tested or they can buy them cheaper, untested. And so oftentimes they buy them cheaper. And they will go to sites that take small payments or micro payments or free subscriptions where you've got to put a credit card in and you get a free trial for 7 days, those types of things. And they will wait to see if that card is approved, if it's authorized. If it is, they will go out and resell that card on the market for a higher margin. So the delta between what they bought it and they sell it at, they make some money there. And what they will do is they'll go on a site and they'll act just like a customer. And we've got a customer that was seeing hundreds of those come in on a daily basis because they did one of those 7-day free trials. You have to have a credit card. You sign up. You get your free access. And at the end of 7 days, either the credit card would be charged, and it didn't matter because the fraudster got the information they wanted, and they got a high chargeback rate because of that. But card testers are going out there to see if the card they have purchased or stolen is actually valid and can be used in a process. There are ways to stop that. There are ways to come in and see if that card is actually in the same region as the customer, what's the bill to, what's the ship to, what's the email address. There's all kinds of different ways to detect whether that is a card tester or if that's actually the person that is making the purchase. Dave, anything to add to that?
I mean, card testing is definitely, you know, a real problem. And obviously, you know, from a history perspective, you know, card testing used to be done at the gas pump. And they'd put them on a card and go test to see if they could get an authorization on the card right there at the gas pump. But with, you know, Internet and online markets today, obviously it's much easier to just go to a website and basically test to see if a card can actually get an authorization. And fraudsters will basically look for websites that, you know, basically have trial programs where they're doing an authorization, like a $0 or a $1 authorization to see if a card works. They'll also basically go to sites that are doing small payments, like, you know, under $10 typically, where they can then, you know, see if they can actually use the card to again, either resell it or basically test to make sure it works before they actually go to, you know, another site to actually commit the real fraud that they're interested in performing. You know, they just want to make sure that, you know, the credentials that they use are valid. So it's a definite problem, and you know, there are a number of business practices as well as controls that you can put in place to basically make your site unfriendly to card testing. You know, but it's definitely a problem.
You know, the interesting thing is we've seen some of these fraudster organizations are very, very corporate-like, and they'll have their junior fraudsters do the card testing. And when the junior fraudsters find cards that are good, they pass them up to the senior fraudsters to do the real fraud.
Oh, God.
They'll go out and they do the fishing, and when they get a fish, they send it up the line for the experienced guys to go use it and rip you off otherwise. I saw another question come in here, Melissa, on I'm a small business. I accept credit cards overseas. How can I check if the billing information matches? I only ship to the billing address. I know through our system we have a partner, 192.com. They are an overseas information database similar to a Targus or a LexisNexis, and they will look at billing information, shipping information, and see if there's a match. There's a fee. I don't know exactly what it is. I don't think it's huge. Dave, any other thoughts on something like that?
Well, yeah, first of all, it needs to be clearly understood. When, you know, for us in the United States, you know, we understand this thing called AVS, address verification, you know, that basically, you know, looks to see if the address matches the billing information with the issuer. Now, that really, you know, that works really well in the U.S. It works kind of well in Canada, and it works okay in the U.K. Not you know, I actually think okay is probably being too generous. It doesn't work that well there, and it works nowhere else. It's not available anywhere else. So, you know, in terms of AVS, you're just going to get an indication back basically saying it's an international card, so, you know, or it's unavailable. You will have to typically use a third-party service to basically, you know, try to match that information together. And it's typically not going to be the billing. It's not really, you know, they're not really matching that information to the actual issuer data. You know, like if you're doing something in Germany, they're not matching it to that particular card, like, you know, to see if that address is there. They're really just matching it to the public record to actually see, you know, is there really basically somebody living at that address with that particular name. So the risk does change a little bit, but there are other ways that you can kind of mitigate or manage that risk. But, you know, yeah, 192.com, a service like that allows you to, you know, see if this information logically goes together is a way you can do it. But, you know, it really depends on, you know, multiple factors. You know, how much money is that, you know, are we talking about in terms of the transaction? You know, what's the margin set and what's the risk exposure in terms of the product that's being offered? And then, obviously there are some other things that you could do instead of that.
Okay, Great. Well, I think we're just about out of time. So I would sort of reiterate, though, what Don said earlier, that if you have any other questions, please feel free to send them to us, and we'll get them to Don and David.
Melissa, can I just say, I did see a question come up. I will get with you, Mike, and answer your question and make sure that we follow up with you on. And if anybody else has questions, feel free to contact David or myself. We'll be happy to answer them one-on-one if they need.
Great, excellent. So just wanted to close it out here and say that on behalf of Retail Online Integration and Count, I want to thank you for attending today's webinar. Please be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And also, if you would just take a minute to fill out a brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen next, we would be very, very grateful. Your feedback will help influence the webinars we bring you in the future. Also, thank you to David and Don for two great presentations. So see you at the next Retail Online Integration webinar. Thanks a lot, everybody.